Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on a rainy day here in Dallas, Texas, Monday, April the 10th. We'll be chatting in a few minutes with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Tonight, we're going to be focusing a great deal on foreign policy. There is a lot going on. It's a very dangerous world as we do our show today. You've got Syria, you've got Russia, you've got Iran, China, North Korea. And in the middle of all of this, President Trump. And of course, a lot of the reaction to the attack last week or Thursday night against that Syrian airbase. So there's just a lot of stuff going on foreign policy. Egypt is also an issue. Just lots and lots of stuff going on in the area of foreign policy. It seems like everything has all of a sudden just jumped to the front page when it comes to foreign policy. The role of Congress, of course, is always a big question mark when we do these things. A lot of members of Congress, I think, have been pretty responsible, accepting the idea that President Trump has the authority to attack Syria. It could become a little bit more problematic for President Trump if we escalate beyond this attack, and that's something that we'll be watching over the next few weeks. You know, I was thinking this afternoon. I was out at a meeting this afternoon, and I said to my friend, you know, a year ago, if I had said to you a year ago, April 10th, 2016, that on April 10th, 2017, a Republican president would be appearing at the swearing in of a man like Neil Gorsuch as the Supreme Court Justice, I think most of us a year ago would have been thrilled. We'd be saying what a tremendous 60, 70 days the Republican president is having. Well, that's what happened today. We have a new justice, a wonderful man. And I got to say congratulations to Senator McConnell for really managing this thing. It was in February of 2016 that Justice Scalia passed away. And 14 months later, we have a replacement for Justice Scalia in the name of Gorsuch. So great job by Senator McConnell. Susan Rice has been in the news here lately, way too much in the news. She has a problem telling stories. And the latest controversy, of course, has to do with exactly what weapons did Syria have or didn't have. So we have a lot to get into with Bill. And let's say hello to Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. How are you, Bill?
Oh, just fine, Silvio. I was very delighted to watch the swearing in of Justice Gorsuch today. It was a great moment, a Scalia moment. And, you know, it's always inspiring to see the swearing in of any Supreme Court justice, because they are the highest judges in the land, but particularly one as well qualified as he. And I also noted the fact that the entire Supreme Court showed up, which is not often the case in these swearings in. I look forward to great things from him. I also think that people are already speculating that there will be at least one other Supreme Court opening this year. There is an expectation, it's not confirmed, that Justice Kennedy, for whom Justice Gorsuch once clerked, will be retiring at the end of this session. If that is the case, then obviously President Trump will have another opening to fill, and with no filibuster facing him. So that should be a relatively easy task.
What do you think of what the conversation I was having with my friend this afternoon about a year ago? If we were sitting a year ago, 2016, and we had said that this seat would remain open for 14 months and that it would be filled by a man like Neil Gorsuch, I would have felt pretty good a year ago, Bill, if you had told me that. So, I mean, this is a big deal for President Trump, I think.
It is. It is. The Democrats, of course, are very bitter. They felt that this should have been their seat, that the opening occurred in the last year of the Obama administration with the death of Justice Scalia. And President Obama, as you recall, nominated Merrick Garland, who, by the way, is a very fine man. It was a distinguished appointment. But the Republicans said, no, there's a long tradition that we don't confirm Supreme Court justices in presidential election years. And that is true. That is, it's gone back 80 years. And they stalled it. And we got to a Republican administration and Neil Gorsuch. I think that, you know, depending on what happens in the future, it is possible that if there's an opening, I suspect President Trump will appoint another conservative. That is something that would have to occur rather quickly, because I'm not at all certain that the Republicans can hold the Senate in next year's midterms. We hope they can. The Democrats have a lot of seats that are exposed next year, but traditionally the party in power in the White House loses seats in the midterm elections. The Republicans only have a 2-seat majority in the Senate, and it will not be difficult for them to lose control of the Senate, in which case, if there's a Supreme Court opening afterward, there will have to be some compromise with Democrats. So right. I hope that the president gets his openings before the 2018 elections.
Isn't it interesting, Bill, this point you just mentioned, isn't it interesting how 2 or 3 months ago it was a given that the Republicans would pick up Senate seats in 2018?
Yes.
And now here we're talking about, I mean, you're exactly right. In the first year, in the first midterm of any president, he usually takes a beating. I think the only exception was President Bush in 2002, who actually gained the Senate. I think he was only one down. I think it was a 50-50 tie or whatever. But he actually did gain the Senate that year. But most of the time, they lose seats, like you're saying. And yes, I mean, the Republicans, even though they have a lot of advantages, history is against them in that respect, Bill.
It is. And we should point out that even in the midterm election, where by all logic the president in power should have gained seats, which was the 1942 midterms, coming less than a year after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt took a beating. And this was during the, you know, a conflict in which the country was united, a victory was on everybody's lips, and yet the commander-in-chief lost a number of seats in 1942. It is the usual tendency of the country to turn against the very person they've elected as president, the contrariness of the democratic system. But let's see what happens. It's still a long way off. President Trump, I think, is feeling the presidency for the first time. I think his handling of the Syria situation was brilliant. He has good people around him, and you never know. A year from today, we can be talking about a president with a pretty good approval rating. Or a president whose approval rating is no worse than any other at that point.
Yeah, I mean, things are so unpredictable in this business that, you know, you're exactly right. Who knows what will happen? I mean, who would have predicted, for example, I don't want to get too historical here, but who would have predicted in March or April of 2009 that the Republicans would have the kind of comeback they had in 2010? I certainly didn't predict that. So,
right.
These things have a way of changing. They're so unpredictable. But before we get to foreign policy, why don't we continue with the Democrats for a minute? The Democrats, they would have to hold on to just about everything they have, you know, West Virginia, Missouri, Montana, one of the Dakotas. I mean, they would really have to hold on to those seats that where Republicans usually win. But it seems to me the Democrats are very discredited with most of the country, not their base, but with most of the country after the Gorsuch nomination, because I thought their performance was just absolutely despicable. I mean, they could have voted against him. That's one thing. But to try to, you know, do the filibuster and all the crap that we heard about Gorsuch, who's a fine human being, I mean, I just, you know, they didn't make – it wasn't the best that the Democrats could have done, Bill. I don't know how anybody can feel very proud of of the job that they did, Bill.
They have no reason to feel proud, but the Democratic leadership today seems to be completely under the control of what they politely call their base. How big that base is, I don't know. It seems to be the people who shout the loudest, and they are leftists. I mean, they're not liberals anymore. They're leftists. They're mean-spirited, and their instruction to their leaders is go against anything Trump is for, or else. Or else there will be real consequences down the line. We'll run primary candidates against you. This is the old move-on crowd. They're to the left of Hillary Clinton. They're really to the left of, I think, Schumer, who is the minority leader of the Senate, is running particularly scared because he is not the kind of person they like. And so he went along with it, I mean, because Chuck Schumer is a very ambitious man. But one of the things we've learned about the left, in fact, we've talked about it on this program, is you can't satisfy them. It's 100%. You must give them 100%, 100% of the time. And so this might actually get worse. I mean, the Democrats, there were some Democratic support, I have to concede, for the strike on Syria. Some of the shrewder Democrats, understanding what the situation was, did give some limited support. But that, you know, I have what I call the 48-hour rule, that no matter what event occurs, it takes 48 hours for the left to reorganize and go right back to their old party line. And that's pretty much what's happened. I mean, now that 48 hours has passed since the Syria strike, you now hear the voices of the left starting to emerge that Trump is a warrior, doesn't have the experience, this and that. It's interesting, though, that he's gone up very strongly against Russia. And now what are they going to say? Because the whole Democratic Party's reason for existence was apparently to expose some deep love between Putin and Trump. Now, that's ludicrous right now because Trump is being very harsh on Putin and Putin is being very harsh on Trump. So, where does the Democratic go with the Russia thing now? It goes nowhere. What is interesting, though, is that Trump's first major action, as opposed to the routine things like appointing people, in policy was the Syria strike. And it was done very quickly, very efficiently, in a very limited way. It sent a very powerful message, though, that we have a new president and a new kind of president in the White House. And I'd be fascinated to see what happens now down the line.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about that in a minute because I want to spend a lot of time talking about this very complicated world. But just one more thing about the Democrats and Senator Schumer. I think if I was Senator Schumer and these, as you call them, the base, I don't think they're really the base. I think it's an extreme part of the Democrat Party, but they make a lot of noise and contribute a lot of money, which is probably why they have so much influence. But I think if they were to walk into my office, I would say to them, look what you made me do. I had to give up the 60 votes against Gorsuch, and now the next time we have to fill a seat, I'm not going to have the 60 votes to work with. So, you know, you basically put us in a weaker position, and I would argue that with people in the base. They won't understand it, but nevertheless, I really do think the Democrats are in a weaker position because of that 60-vote rule, and I wouldn't be surprised if that goes out the window altogether, not just for judges, Bill.
It's quite possible, and you're absolutely right. I'm sure that Schumer deep down would love to tell the base, look what you made me do. You put us in a weaker position. But the kind of base the Democratic Party has right now doesn't care. They are much more interested in making ideological points than in winning. And to them, Chuck Schumer is a despicable character. He represents the more thoughtful liberal wing of the Democratic Party. They're not interested. These are real hardline ideologists. The Republican Party has the same thing, by the way. They have their right wing Tea Party group in the party, the Freedom Caucus, which can also be very difficult to work with because they are rigid ideologists, and that's not what makes government go.
No, not at all. It's very difficult to govern with these minorities that do not understand that the only reason they're the majority, I mean, the only reason the Freedom Caucus members can get good committee assignments is because there's a bunch of Republicans who were elected with 51-52% of the vote. That's why we have a majority, not because of the Freedom Caucus. If it was up, you know, the Freedom Caucus is, I hate to compare them this way, but ideologically, or not ideologically, but in the sense of being in the extreme, they're a lot like, for example, the Black Congressional Caucus, which is basically an extreme part of the party that by itself would never create a majority, but they, you know, they do say no to everything. And I think the Freedom Caucus, to some extent, will do the same thing. I think they were responsible for the bill not coming out of Congress, although that in retrospect may not have been such a bad idea considering how Obamacare is imploding. We're going to take a little break, Bill. When we come back, I want to talk about Dr. Susan Rice, and I want to talk about all this foreign policy, which is it is really unsafe out there. It is really an unsafe world. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Bill, very quickly, you and I have had several conversations over the last few weeks or a few months about CNN, and I finally had a chance to actually watch CNN. I happened to be sitting at a restaurant, and they were the channel that was on, so I had a chance to watch it for about 30 minutes, and it seemed like all they do is talk about Bill O'Reilly, Bill. I've never seen anything like I've never seen anything like that.
CNN
CNN
is turning into a caricature of itself.
Yeah, but I mean, why? I mean, you worked with Johnny Carson. Do you think Johnny Carson would do a segment on, I don't know, the Vic Cavett? I mean, would he spend time talking about him? No,
well,
doesn't make any sense. No.
No, it's small-time stuff.
It was really fascinating because I was sitting there watching doing a whole segment and what a horrible person Bill O'Reilly is. And look, I'm not here to defend O'Reilly. I like his show, but I mean, he may have some personal problems and that's fine. But I mean, for CNN to spend that much time talking about him, it really shows that maybe they have a base problem too, that they're drawing the same kind of base that MSNBC is drawing, Bill.
I think that's exactly right, by the way. I think that the business plan at CNN, which also comports with the Jeff Zucker's political views, Jeff Zucker being the head of CNN and very much a liberal, he was the one responsible for the career of Katie Couric. Apparently, this is my theory, and that is his business plan is to build on CNN's past as a major news organization and draw enough left-wing viewers from MSNBC and other sources to build a network. It will not be as big as Fox. It will not have the audience that Fox has, but it will be a large enough audience to make a substantial profit and continue. And that, you know, my feeling is that when you watch CNN, you are watching a very well-organized anti-Trump television network. Those people all didn't come to the same conclusion about Trump at the same time. This is obviously organized. This is their game plan. It's their business model. And I believe it is starting to fail. I did notice a little bit of moderating on the part of CNN in the last 4 or 5 days since the Syria strike. But still, when they go back to their normal routine of Trump bashing, they sound like a network out of the past. They sound like, they sound like what MSNBC sounds like. I mean, if Trump should suddenly become quite popular, and I think it is possible, CNN will look ridiculous because the only way Trump can become popular is by doing things that are popular, not just as popularity as an individual. And in that case, he means that we will have achieved certain successes. What is CNN going to say? I mean, every second word out of their mouth is they have found some contradiction. They have found some feud in the White House. They have found somebody who didn't put his paperclips away. Paperclips can do damage. You know, I mean, that is the level of that network, and it is becoming completely ridiculous.
Well, I'm sure they're going to do a segment pretty soon on who's burning the coffee every morning.
Yes.
at the intelligence meetings or whatever. But I thought it was pretty bad. I mean, I have to tell you that I it's been a long time since I watched CNN. I think the last time I watched any of it was at an airport, and that was about a year before. It just seemed to me like it was pretty silly. It was difficult to stay with it. I mean, I guess that's the worst part. There was nothing interesting about it. You know, when you're sitting there bashing Bill O'Reilly, you know, at what point is that just childish? I mean, that's what I kept thinking. And again, I like Bill O'Reilly, and I understand he's had some problems. From what I understand, I don't know anything for sure. But leave him alone. Come on. I mean, I was thinking to myself as I was watching that segment, Bill, that maybe Bill O'Reilly should have the ultimate joke. He should leave Fox and go work for CNN.
Yes, and they'd probably be happy to have him. You know, he's a big ratings draw. Well, I think that these attacks on Riley are so petty. I mean, nobody is interested in CNN's attempt to compete with Fox. I mean, they are interested in the news and what CNN is putting out. It is just so petty. I was watching, or actually not watching, I was reading about their media analyst, whose name I forget, he's young, on CNN, and he was bashing O'Reilly for covering that story of a girl being allegedly raped at Rockville High School in Maryland. And the media analyst was saying the only reason O'Reilly covered this is because the alleged assailant was an illegal immigrant. It's all about the immigration story. He doesn't care about the rape. There are rapes every day. Well, that's just, first of all, the wrong thing to say. It's entirely legitimate for O'Reilly to cover that story because he wants to illustrate the potential danger of unvetted immigrants. That's a perfectly legitimate news point. And also, it's not too healthy to go on the air and say, well, the only reason you cover this is the rape and not mention how serious that crime is, as if it's just a minor crime. It's a very major crime. So it's the trivia that is coming off CNN is quite remarkable. By the way, I noticed today something that was very interesting from a media viewpoint, and that is that two of the three broadcast networks, meaning CBS, NBC, and ABC, two of the three did cover the swearing-in of Judge Gorsuch as a live media event. The two were NBC and ABC. CBS, which used to be the leading news network of the world, really, did not cover it. They kept with their game shows. But I was gratified to see two of the three did cover it. And for one brief moment, I did not have to rely on a cable news system to see a news event. So, you know.
Well, it's like the good old days, right? The good old days when you could get all your news from the regular stations, you know? You didn't have to have cable at one time, yeah. You could have all these break-in events that you could watch on regular cable. I thought another thing, too, about tying into Dr. Susan Rice, I thought the way that CNN handled the Susan Rice story, you know, literally going on the air and saying, this is not a story, this is a fake news from right-wing sources, I thought that was pretty irresponsible, too, Bill, because I mean, you would think the curiosity would lead a reporter to simply ask the question, why was she unmasking these? I mean, what was the reason? And yet they immediately said, no, there's no story here. I thought that was pretty irresponsible, Bill.
That was mostly Don Lemon who did that. It was just basically a function of the Democratic Party on CNN. I remember it. I was shocked by it, too. And it looks especially bad now because Rice, who has a history of dishonesty in public statements, Rice has now been caught again. The Washington Post giving her four Pinocchios in their lying index, which is the worst you can get, for informing America that all the Syrian chemical weapons had been destroyed. And it clearly was not true. They have chemical weapons, and she's caught once again. So CNN's a pompous declaration. I recall Don Lemon saying, "We will not insult your intelligence by putting this false story on the air." And now the very person who they were trying to defend has been caught once again not telling the truth. I think the Susan Rice issue is a fascinating one. I mean,
yes.
this is a woman who you could not give her a lie detector test because she's so extreme in her lies. I don't think any machine was built for this. You know, I mean, it might destroy the machine. There might be an extra expense involved. But this is somebody with a very, very serious record of making untruthful public statements.
Well, and she's, I mean, the allegation against her is unmasking of U.S. citizens, which is a crime.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
I find it interesting that in her own remarks about this, first of all, she says, I hope I've got this right, but I think initially she said, "I don't know anything about it." And then she
That's
said,
right.
"Well, I was unmasking, but not for political reasons." Well, that's a leap. Don't you think, Bill? That's a big leap from saying, "I didn't know anything about it," to, "Yes, I did it, but I didn't do it for that reason." That's a big leap in my mind,
Well,
Bill.
Yes, her mind was jolted into a recognition that she did know something about it. Well, that was Susan Rice. I mean, she has gone out. She was the one who was sent out after Benghazi. And we now know from the emails that the United States government knew the night of the attack that it was a terrorist attack, but Susan Rice was sent out that week to all the Sunday talk shows to say that the attack was simply caused by an irresponsible video. It was a lie. It was a blatant lie, and she's never apologized for the lie. Now we've had her caught at lying, saying she knew nothing about this, when in fact she knew everything about it. She lied about the weapons of mass destruction in Syria. At what point is she going to be held to account? If I were the Republican majority in either House of Congress, I would subpoena her to appear before a committee and explain herself. I don't know if that will happen, but it certainly is something that should happen.
Well, it should happen because it's potentially a very serious crime. And we're talking about the privacy
Yes.
of American citizens. I mean, this is a pretty serious matter. My suspicion tells me that there's something going on. I mean, that this is not just, as Don Lemon would say, just nothing. I do think there's something going on. Whether she did it for political reasons or not, that might be difficult to prove. But then on the other hand, isn't she a political appointment? I mean, why would she be handling this kind of information? And then there's another story by Congressman King out of your area, in New York. I think he's not far from where you live.
Yes,
Congressman,
King,
I think it's John
from Long
King.
Island, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Peter
and
King.
He was saying that Peter King was saying that there was apparently a lot of information they were gathering on these people, a lot of personal information, sort of similar to what you would do, the kinds of investigations you would do, let's say during a divorce proceedings when you've got investigative people out digging up information on one party. The other, he said that's the kind of information that he saw in the files. If that's true, Bill, that's pretty serious.
It is serious because her excuse, lame excuse, I believe, was that, well, information was picked up in the course of me doing my job as National Security Advisor, and the implication was that they were eavesdropping on some foreign official, and by some coincidence, some Americans called that foreign official. Maybe to arrange a social date or a vacation or a cruise somewhere in the Caribbean, and that my goodness, we picked up a Joe Blow, but that was not the purpose, she said. Well, as Congressman King said, the record seems to show that they acquired an awful lot of personal information about these Americans who were, quote, caught on this surveillance, and that they spread it around. If that is true, yes, that's a very serious crime and a real threat to the integrity of the political process. Whether they'll unmask this, whether the Republicans will endure, I don't know. They have a way of not enduring, and I always wonder whenever Republicans start anything whether they have the stamina to finish it, because the Democrats are going to defend her in every way. You know, she's a woman of color. She was in the Obama administration. And they will have on their side the press, which will figure out ways to defend the indefensible. The Republicans will really have to be persistent and endure and hold her to the fire. And I hope they do.
I thought it was kind of interesting looking back now at that first week of March, that President Trump had that tweet about surveillance or whatever, whatever he said back then. Who would have thought that, you know, that he was on to something? I think a lot of us back then said, well, he better have some evidence. And then he said in an interview, well, some things are going to come out in the next few weeks. I had no idea that it would be anything like this, Bill. Yeah, it did. So you have to wonder, you know, I don't know. I think there's a lot more coming with Dr. Rice. I think we're going to be chatting about her quite a bit. But let's move to foreign policy, Bill, because it seems like a very complicated world tonight. You've got Syria, you've got Russia, you've got Iran, you've got North Korea, you've got China. I'm not sure if I missed anybody. In Sweden now they had a terrorist act, a horrible terrorist act, and I think they're starting to reconsider their immigration policies from what I understand. So it's a very unsafe world. Where would you like to start? I mean, it seems like every one of these options is pretty ugly, though.
Well, yes, and also add to that those terrible terrorist attacks in Egypt over the weekend directed at the Egyptian Christians. You could start almost anywhere. It's a world that was left to President Trump by a president, Barack Obama, who either didn't care or was remarkably incompetent about dealing with foreign policy. But I look back upon the Obama foreign policy, and I can't find a single example of a success. And that includes the Iran nuclear deal, because essentially what it guarantees is that Iran eventually will have the atomic bomb. I think the one that is generally regarded as the most serious in Washington is North Korea, because North Korea already is a nuclear power, it already is a missile power, and it is run by a government that appears to be completely irrational and thoroughly indifferent to international pressure. And I do believe that the president would like to finally find some kind of solution to the North Korea problem, which would mean their ceasing of their weapons of mass destruction programs. But I don't know how that can actually be done. I think everybody wants a political settlement. Nobody wants a military settlement. But he has an aircraft carrier strike group that will be stationed in Korean waters, and I have no idea what he's going to do. It is not a policy that is fully developed, and there was no really real way to fully develop it, as early in the administration. But I think that one thing that President Trump understands is these crises with nations cannot go on and on and on and on without some resolution. The American people will expect results. And in the case of North Korea, this can be very harrowing.
Well, the only thing I thought that could happen with North Korea is if they try to fire a missile. I know that at one time, I remember watching Newt Gingrich say that we should just blow it up before it takes off.
Yes.
That we should just take it out. Now, the downside to that, of course, is that what if he attacks South Korea?
Yes.
So you have to have,
that,
you know, you have to have all your...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's the risk, because there's, 10 million people across the border? I mean, that's the risk right there, but...
Yes.
Go ahead.
There's a very substantial number of South Koreans, I don't know the exact figure, who live close to the armistice line in Korea, and on the North Korean side is a very, very sizable buildup of artillery pieces. And it's said that if war were to commence, if that artillery started to go and was not stopped, it could kill literally millions of South Koreans. They are, in effect, hostages to this situation.
Right, exactly. I thought it was interesting, Bill. Saturday night, one of my son's high school friends came over. They hadn't seen each other for a while. And he came over, and he's from South Korea, this young man. He's from South Korea. So we were talking a little bit. I asked him... this is a young man in his 20s. And I talked a little bit about North Korea with him, and I said, does your family have any family in the North by any chance? And he said, no, we don't have any family up there. And he says, in fact, that it's extremely uncommon for anybody in the South to have any family in the North. And I thought that was so interesting. Well, it's been 65 years. I guess that does have, maybe that's part of the explanation. But, you know, I kept thinking about, let's say, people in Cuba and people in Miami. There are a lot of family connections, you know. And even in West Germany and East Germany, there were some family connections. But in the case of the two Koreas, they are two completely different countries. And this young man was even telling me that they don't, you know, the people in South Korea are much better fed, of course, much healthier. They're even bigger. They're taller than the people in the North. I mean, it's like there's no comparison between these two Koreas, Bill.
Well, yes. You've probably seen that very famous picture that Don Rumsfeld used to like to hold up, showing the Korean Peninsula photographed at 11, I think it was 11 o'clock at night. And North Korea was absolutely black, and South Korea was glowing with lights. You know, it's a portrait of two societies. One is a living, breathing, free society. The other is a completely repressed society. And the concerns that have been expressed about North Korea are absolutely accurate. There's an irrationality to their government, and we don't know what they might actually do with some of these weapons. You know, will they see their future in becoming martyrs and launching a nuclear-tipped missile at the United States when they develop that equipment? It's not a risk I would want to take, that's for sure. We don't know.
No.
But they have become a major threat to the world, not only because of their own weapon systems, but because they export those weapons and export that technology. And the idea, for example, of North Korean technology going to Al-Qaeda or to ISIS or to a government that is hostile to the United States like Iran, it's a frightening possibility.
Well, and they're so irrational. I mean, they're irrational enough to do it, but they need cash. That's the other thing, too. They need cash. I'm sure all of that military machine that they have, I mean, that costs a lot of money. So, you know, that they're not an exporting country. They don't have any natural exports as with, let's say, South Korea. So they've got to get cash under the table wherever possible. One of the big stories, Bill, this week is the behavior of Putin. It seemed like at first everybody was saying, well, Putin agrees with the strike. Now Putin has become very aggressive and very critical. Yeah. I don't know how much of that is just for the show or how much of that is real, Bill. What's your sense?
I think he's negotiating, you know, and that's the way he negotiates. He negotiates by acting very tough and trying to scare people, and there will be a certain number of people, especially in Western Europe, who will be scared by that kind of rhetoric. But I think he is trying to get the best possible deal he can from the United States. He has been extremely harsh, and we'll have to see what happens. Rex Tillerson is going to Russia. Rex Tillerson knows, our Secretary of State, knows Putin personally, and we'll see what comes of that. It could deteriorate. I mean, this is a very, very volatile situation.
It could also be that, and this is just a crazy theory on my part, Bill, but maybe Putin is trying to get out of Syria because he's sort of put himself in a situation, maybe a no-win situation. I mean, what is he going to get out of Syria, or at least Syria the way it is right now? So maybe he's trying to get out of Syria. That's a crazy idea of mine.
I don't think it's crazy. I don't think we really know what Putin's gambit is in the Middle East. But remember, for many years, the Russians were kind of kept out of the Middle East, in part because they lost the Cold War and nobody was inviting them back in, but in other part because they just essentially lost out to the United States. But when the Obama administration came along and this, you know, kid in the White House wanted to develop a new policy, he developed a new policy that weakened our own hold on the Middle East, our influence, and it was weakened very quickly. And who goes into, you know, the old story, politics abhors a vacuum. Who is going into the vacuum but Russia and its old Communist Party apparatchiks. So I think that Putin sees Russia with having a substantial influence in the Middle East, even having ports and possibly airfields and possibly formal alliances. And I think he considers this a very logical extension of the Russian Empire.
Yeah. Now, we gave him about 60 minutes to notice, I guess, that we were going to attack. So at least he knows that we were not trying to hit his planes or his pilots. But my theory is that Putin would rather get out of the Middle East, in one piece, and concentrate more on expanding the Russian Empire in Ukraine and some of the territory where he would have at least some military advantage because of the proximity and because of the tanks that he's already accumulated there, whereas in Syria or in the Middle East, he has to rely on a navy, he's got to rely on an air force. It's a bit more complicated. He's got a lot further to travel, Bill.
He does, and we remember the fact that the breakup of the old Soviet Union to a certain degree was symbolized by their difficulty in Afghanistan, that they went into Afghanistan to keep down anti-Soviet forces. This was in the late 70s, and they basically got defeated there. They got sucked into an intractable situation. That may very well be what they have in mind right now, and there may be people in the Kremlin asking exactly what you're asking. What's in this for us? And they may come to the conclusion, again, as you pointed out, that it would be much better for Russia to withdraw and strengthen its position somewhere else where they have real influence and full knowledge of the language. I think everything is up in the air right now. We don't actually know what Putin's goals are.
Well, that's it. That's it. Everything is up in the air, and since we don't know what his goals are, I mean, he could be wishing to get further into the Middle East, or as I was speculating, to get out of the Middle East altogether and say, well, why did I even get into this mess when I can do better closer to home? Now, one of the countries, Bill, that I want to bring up is Iran, because they've been pretty tough, too, on President Trump and the attack in Syria. And I'm a lot more concerned about Iran because they've been very emboldened over the last couple of years, particularly by that nuclear deal that we did, or the Iran deal. So I'm more worried about Iran. I think Iran could be the bigger problem between Iran and Russia in that region. I would worry a lot more about Iran, Bill.
Well, so would I. But I don't, I can't imagine Iran making an irrational attack somewhere in the Middle East, but I could be very wrong. Maybe that's exactly what they'll do. They are very disappointed in this because they were going so well against the United States. They had Barack Obama essentially almost on their side, and he was treating Iran as a major power, showing respect for them. Then there is this very unexpected change of administrations in the United States, and now they find themselves a pariah again. So, yes, Iran is a very, very important country in the world right now, and right now it is, in a way, sitting on top of that world until Trump pushes them off, and that may be what they fear.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, one last thing about foreign policy, and then we'll take a break, and then I want to go back home for a second, come back to the United States, but some of the people who voted for President Trump were actually very disappointed with his military action, basically saying, this is not the Trump that I voted for.
Yes.
Now, you may remember a year ago or so when we were talking about then-candidate Donald Trump, one of the reasons that I wasn't crazy about him was the fact that I felt he was a bit of an isolationist, that I felt that he would be the kind of man who, in a sense, would forget about all these problems and just say, we're going to build bridges and schools in the United States. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. We do need to build better bridges. But I was always concerned about it. But with his action, it seems like people like me are happy, and yet many of his strong supporters are unhappy, Bill.
Yes. Well, he has a multi-layered support base, and part of that base, and a very vocal part is a neo-isolationist base that you know, believes that we should get out of the Middle East, believes that we should, you know, it's almost George McGovern's entreaty to come home America. And they believe we've been far too active militarily in the Middle East and we haven't gotten anything for it. And yes, they are disappointed, but I think they are expressing any disappointment with some restraint. I mean, I don't think they're going crazy the way the Democrats go crazy.
Well, so far, because you know, the action
yes.
was limited and very successful. I mean, nothing works like success, but you know, you never know. I mean, but I thought it was the right move because I think it sent the message that if you're going to use chemical weapons, you've got a problem. You got to think twice about it now after last week. I'm not saying that we're going to be bombing every airbase every time a plane takes off, but if you're bombing civilians with chemical gas, we have a problem and we're willing to act. And I think that's something, frankly, I wish that had happened 5 years ago, Bill. Think of the many images that we've seen over the last few years of Aleppo and these other places, little children, you know, that was all because we were weak. At least we're not going to see that again, Bill, and that's comforting to know, Bill.
I think that's true. I don't think Americans yet realize the enormity of the damage that Barack Obama did to our foreign policy. He didn't believe, first of all, in his own country. He didn't particularly like his own country. And the foreign policy he pursued right from the first day was a policy that showed contempt for our foreign policy traditions. You know, he went on his magical apology tour to Cairo, for example, and apologized for the United States, which was an absolute disgrace. He showed very little regard for the military, and he showed very little regard for the war on terror. You recall, of course, that under his administration, you weren't supposed to say terror. You were supposed to say a man-made disaster. They tried to reinvent the entire vocabulary, and I think we are seeing the result of that attitude right now in the fact that our position in the Middle East was very substantially eroded, and President Trump
is
trying to get it back.
You're exactly right. We're going to take a little break, but I guarantee you that the people in Sweden are calling it terrorism. They're not calling
it
a disaster. Oh, yeah, that's right. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with one more segment with Bill right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, the Week in Review with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We've got one more segment with Bill. Bill, I thought it was very fascinating. You wrote a post yesterday about free college tuition in New York. Of course, it's not free, but whatever happened to that? Did it pass or is it still an idea?
I think it's being submitted, and I think there's a good chance it will pass. It is one of those ideas that has become very trendy, and I would imagine that New York will be one of a number of states to offer this. It does come with some restrictions. You have to spend a certain number of years in New York State after graduation, although I don't know how they can enforce that. I mean, I really don't. I am not in favor of it as written. I think it's wonderful to be able to provide some help to students who want to go to college. But this is one of those blanket things like the GI Bill. Apparently you can study anything you want. And I think this is coming at a time when many people are seriously questioning what is going on our college campuses and what is being taught on our college campuses. I would have much preferred some kind of program, if there has to be any program at all, that would be linked, one, to a college's endowment. I don't think it is fair to calculate these things the same way for a traditionally black college, for example, as for or as opposed to Columbia University, which has a multi-billion dollar endowment. And I also think aid should be pegged in certain respects to what you study. The country has certain needs, and I don't believe that there's anything wrong with specifying, well, if you study chemistry or physics, we're going to give you more money than if you study oppression studies or the history of my people on the Pacific Islands between 1340 and 1960. You know, I think that we have a right to spend our money in ways that actually enhance our prospects as a state.
Right. No, I agree with you. Now, another thing too, Bill, that is happening and could be happening or could be true any moment is the state of California has decided to go sanctuary.
Yes.
And I find that to be absolutely insane. I mean, it's bad enough to have cities, but now you've got a state. And there's a very interesting article that came out. We're not going to have time to get into it today, but maybe in another time, at another show. A very interesting article that came out, I think I may have sent you a copy of it, talking about how the state of California is really becoming two states. You've got the coast and you've got the interior. And all of the policies are being made by people on the coast. They're the ones running the show. The people in the interior are sort of being pushed around. They don't have a seat at the table, as someone was quoted in the article. I don't think that's sustainable, by the way. I think at some point you're going to see those in the interior who represent agricultural interests and smaller towns and a lot of small businesses. I think there's going to be a clash there. And sanctuary cities is one of the clashes because many of the people in the interior don't want the sanctuary cities. It seems to be of a coastal thing, Bill. So just one more crazy stuff that comes out of California.
Not only coastal, but it's very heavily centered in the San Francisco Bay Area. There are subtle differences along the California coast politically, but the San Francisco Bay Area is probably the national mecca for nutty ideas. And it is very left-wing, especially the city of San Francisco, and very much devoted to the sanctuary status. Now, my question about this is, what happens if the President of the United States challenges that status and is able to get sanctuary cities or sanctuary states declared illegal? What happens then? If, for example, the state government of California doesn't recognize the court decision and keeps on doing exactly what it's doing, you could have a really serious situation, one that could involve violence, one that could involve Americans shooting at each other. You know, we remember in 1957 that President Dwight Eisenhower sent federal troops into Arkansas because Arkansas would not follow a court order integrating a Little Rock Central High School. And that is the kind of thing that can happen again, a refusal on the part of California to abide by national laws. And I dread to think of what could happen, but it could.
It could, because they seem to be so firm on their position on sanctuary cities. Looking at next week, Bill, what are some of the issues that you'll be keeping an eye on?
Well, clearly Syria. Obviously, that story is far from over. We'll be following the Secretary of State as he confronts Putin directly in Moscow. Another area is that Trump seems to be on a little bit of a roll. We will be examining whether it's going to affect his public opinion ratings. I think it's possible that it could, his approval ratings. And we will be looking at Trump's domestic agenda. You have, as it's been pointed out, congressmen from the Republican Party going home on their Easter recess and without a single accomplishment to their name, not a single accomplishment. And I think that's going to be looked at much more seriously in the months ahead. Trump is looking for a congressional victory, and I think it is important that the Republicans in Congress unite to give it to him.
I think so, because he needs to put something on the scoreboard, as we said a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time. Have a great week, and we'll monitor Urgent Agenda, as we always like to do. Keep up the great work, and We'll chat again the next time.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it, Silvio.
All right. Have a great week. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. A lot of stuff going on in the world, and we had a chance to touch base on much of that on the program today. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.